You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. President Joe Biden delivers his State of the Union address tonight, roughly 8 months before the November election. It comes as the president and his administration have been promoting Biden's record in swing states like Wisconsin. WPR's Anya Van Wagtendonk visited the White House and has this report.
In Washington, D.C. earlier this week, a wide range of advisors to President Joe Biden met with reporters to highlight their boss's first-term accomplishments, and they got wonky.
First of its kind, corporate minimum tax.
And under this administration, Medicare is finally at the negotiating table.
60,000 farms, 25 million acres enlisted in climate smart agriculture practices.
That was Daniel Hornung of the National Economic Council, Kristen Link Young of the Domestic Policy Council, and Ali Zaidi, National Climate Advisor. Their message was consistent. Biden is delivering material successes for your community. Stephen Benjamin is the White House Director of Public Engagement.
Our job here at the White House is just believing that good governance is good policy and good politics. So we'll keep doing our jobs and doing it well here.
That approach has been on display in Wisconsin, where the Biden administration has made repeated visits. On Sunday, First Lady Jill Biden was in Waukesha. And yesterday, Vice President Kamala Harris was in Madison to announce an apprenticeship program. She spoke from a construction site for a new bus maintenance facility the Biden administration helped pay to build.
This work that we see behind us is a function of that partnership around how we can get federal dollars out to local governments and local communities.
Last month, Biden himself was in northern Wisconsin to celebrate federal funding for the Blotnick Bridge between Duluth and Superior. His team even produced a short documentary about the project.
Where Duluth and Superior meet represents a key transportation hub in the Great Lakes region where all of the important pieces come together.
These visits underscore a key part of Biden's campaign message. Things like bridges and broadband are a hint of what's to come in his re-election campaign against former President Donald Trump. Anthony Chergosky is a political scientist at UW-La Crosse. He says these kitchen table issues could be a tough sell for Biden at a time when many voters are concerned about high costs. But Chergosky understands why the White House is making the pitch.
Because if that even moves a few voters, that could quite literally be the difference in Wisconsin. And winning Wisconsin could quite literally be the decisive factor in who becomes president.
But veteran Republican operative Mark Grawl says that kind of a campaign likely won't work in this election, a race that pits two very well-known personalities against each other for a second time.
Because so many people have already made up their mind on both former President Trump and current President Biden that I really don't know that that kind of stuff is going to move the needle.
And Wisconsin's GOP congressional delegation has its own pitch on Biden's record. Janesville Republican Brian Stiles says the policies Biden is touting are the reason people should vote against him.
When you have this massive amount of spending coming out of Washington, as this administration is overseeing, what you do is you overstimulate the economy, you drive inflation, and you make things less affordable for families in Wisconsin.
That's a starkly different vision of America than the one being painted back at the White House. Public Engagement Director Stephen Benjamin said he thinks Americans are beginning to feel a shift in economic headwinds.
And hopefully and prayerfully, people will get will feel the benefits in their lives every day and also attribute them directly to the leadership of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
It's a message Democrats continue to drive home in Wisconsin and one that Biden will focus on again in his State of the Union address tonight. But in a hyper-partisan election year, the question is whether voters are listening. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
Anya's with us now to talk more about her time in Washington this week. Anya, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Wisconsin, one of the swingiest of all swing states, as we heard there, could be the key to the presidential election. Just being in the midst of this, do you feel like there's a lot of love coming Wisconsin's way from the White House?
Oh, definitely. I think Wisconsin is really one of only a handful of true swing states that are left. And it was critical to Biden's victory in 2020 over Trump the first time that they went head to head. And so we are seeing a lot of attention, as I mentioned in that story. You know, Vice President Kamala Harris was here yesterday. Jill Biden was in Waukesha Sunday. President Biden was in Superior for the eighth time. It was his eighth time in Wisconsin, I should say, when he was in Superior in January. So I think we can expect lots more visits until November.
And it was really really interesting, the focus there, Anya, because I think we hear from both candidates, we're pretty sure they're both going to be the candidates for the parties now, Biden and Trump, with sort of like, hey, the nation itself is at stake, big ideological differences. But here you report they're really focusing on nuts and bolts. What are we doing for you kind of stuff? Were they really consistent with that message there?
Yeah, definitely. They were really focused on some of Biden's kind of signature legislative achievements. So that includes the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, the CHIPS Act, which is focused on electronics manufacturing. And so a lot of their pitch came from pointing to kind of nitty-gritty outcomes from these spending programs. So, for example, a really big theme was work on cutting prescription drug costs and capping what seniors pay for drugs under Medicare. And I think we can expect the president to bring that up in his address tonight. And another example of this that I think is really interesting is junk fees. It's kind of a consumer-level legislative tweak that's meant to curb like all those little fees that kind of rack up if you're buying Taylor Swift tickets on Ticketmaster or trying to take a trip with Airbnb. That's become another kind of signature issue of this administration. And an economic advisor who spoke to us about it, you know, is arguing that it's a common sense and market-driven policy about putting dollars into people's pockets. But my question is sort of whether voters register those types of changes when they happen, and then who do they attribute it to? Do they attribute that kind of thing to the federal government?
You mentioned that State of the Union address tonight. Now, even if President Biden doesn't say the word Wisconsin 50 times, what are you going to be paying attention to when it comes to policies relevant to the state in tonight's address?
Yeah, so again, I think he's going to point to a lot of what he is touting as the accomplishments of this first term in office, you know, particularly, of course, economic issues, jobs coming out of COVID, I think is going to be a huge theme. And the idea is to kind of point to, look what I've done in 4 years, look what I could do with another 4 years. So I think a lot of those policy issues are going to be front and center. And then I also, you know, expect to hear some talk about our democracy more broadly, kind of unifying of the country. And I think that might be a little bit more of a pie in the sky kind of conversation to be had. But I do think that that's going to be a central theme as well.
And Anya, as we wrap up, whether we like it or not, we've got almost exactly 8 months of presidential campaign ahead of us. What kind of things are you going to be watching for as our state capitol reporter for how the parties tackle this next grueling 8 months?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a really weird election year in so many ways. It's a rematch of two opponents. Both are really unpopular. One is under criminal indictment. Both are facing concerns about their sort of age and general fitness. So it is going to be a really long campaign season. And as you mentioned, it's really unusual for the candidates to be settled this early in the season. So it is going to be 8 months of really, I think, kind of grueling campaigning. And also we're in a time of real hyper-polarization, you know, particularly after COVID and January 6th, people are so locked into their political positions and not necessarily, I think, looking to be swayed. So it'll be really interesting to see what kind of campaign that ends up kind of manifesting on both sides and what we're going to see in terms of how each side is trying to turn out people in what is ultimately an election that is not engendering a lot of enthusiasm right now.
Anya, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Anya Van Wagtendonk, WPR's state capitol reporter. She talked with us about her trip to Washington, D.C. and Biden's upcoming State of the Union address. That is tonight at 8. You can hear it on Wisconsin Public Radio or at WPR.org. Stay with us here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. There's been a lot of attention to the growing divide between Republicans and Democrats in the U.S. in recent years. At the same time, there have been big trends when it comes to who leans left and right. Polling from Gallup and others shows that over the last 10 years, more and more women are identifying as liberal, while men's politics don't see the same shift. And surveys are finding that millennials and Gen Z don't seem to be becoming more conservative as they get older compared to the trends of previous generations. These demographic trends could be a big deal in this election year. Kathleen Dolan is a distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Political Science. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You've been studying gender divisions in politics for a long time now. What strikes you about some of the latest trends we're seeing with this gender gap in politics?
Well, one thing that I would say is there has been a lot of attention in the last month or so to some different surveys that have come out and showed women to be much more likely to identify as liberal than men, in a growing gap. But there are a couple of important things to keep in mind. One is that what most people are reporting is what we would call a self-identification, right? We simply ask people, do they consider themselves to be liberal or moderate or conservative? And so liberal and conservative are political identities. And one of the things that we are seeing in American politics is that people are developing identities around politics in the ways that we used to think about, you know, people would be a Brewers fan or a Packers fan or, you know, somebody who is of Asian descent. And so politics is becoming more sort of centrally entwined in some people's identities. But there is also an important difference between what somebody might call themselves and what they might actually believe or stand for or want government to do. Because if we look at the policy positions and the policy preferences of young women and young men, we don't see the same sort of enormous gap that would suggest that women are much more liberal and men are much more conservative. So one of the things we know in political science research is that people, you know, can label themselves and can use the terms, but often don't necessarily hold consistent policy positions. And so it's important to just keep in mind the fact that there might be more sort of top-level identity and less substantive belief.
When it comes to an activity like voting, based on exit polls and things like that, do we see gaps between men and women?
We do. I mean, generally, we see, you know, the gender gap in the United States is generally that women are more likely to vote for Democratic candidates than are men, and men are a little more likely to vote for Republican candidates. But one of the things that we want to keep in mind about the gender gap is when we focus on the differences between women and men, we are forgetting about all of the variation among women and among men. And so we know that if you look at women in the United States, overall, they tend to be more Democratic than Republican. But there are very important differences based on race, particularly in the United States, where Black women are much more likely to vote for Democratic candidates, and a lot of white women vote for Republican candidates. So there isn't really anything that's as simple as, you know, woman versus man or something like that.
And then flipping it from the voters to the candidates, you've done a lot of work over the years on the concept of electability for women. The notion used to be women aren't electable. I think you've done a lot of work to reverse that thinking. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it is the case that when there were very few women in elected office in the United States, which is for most of our electoral history, people didn't see women as maybe a natural fit in politics. But since the 1990s, as women have steadily become a greater and greater percentage of elected officials in the United States, and people have seen women doing the jobs of vice president and speaker of the house and governor and school board member. And people have seen women candidates run for all of those positions. People have become more comfortable. Most people have become more comfortable. And so the kind of stereotypes and the expectations that people might have had for politics being a male domain has certainly changed. Except among a group of people in the United States who have relatively high levels of what we would call sexism, right? People who have very strong and very traditional ideas about appropriate roles for women and men. But the number of those people in society is declining over time as well.
I want to talk about one particular Republican woman. Nikki Haley just suspended her campaign. She was the first woman, I believe, to win a Republican primary. Not enough of them, but she did win a couple. There were some, and this is anecdotal, there were some news clips of Republican voters saying pretty much flat out they weren't going to vote for Nikki Haley in part because she was a woman. How big a factor do you think that could be within Republican internal politics in particular?
So it is the case that it is more an issue in Republican politics than in Democratic politics. So the first thing I would say is keep in mind that, as you say, you know, everybody can find the anecdotal video of somebody saying something like that on Twitter, but that the number of people, you know, who truly believe those sorts of things is certainly smaller than larger. Now, the evidence does suggest that for Republican women candidates for office, it is a little harder road to hoe to get through, say, Republican primaries to run for office, because the more sexist or more traditionally oriented people in the United States do tend to be older and more conservative and male, and those people tend to vote Republican. So there are pockets of resistance to the candidacy of somebody like Nikki Haley, but it is not the case that we have any evidence at all that Nikki Haley isn't going to be the nominee because she is a woman.
Kathleen Dolan is with us from UW-Milwaukee. We're looking at gender gaps in American politics, how sometimes they're overstated, and now we'll talk about age a little bit, Kathy. So some of the reporting I've seen lately goes along these lines. Okay, it used to be that people, as they got older, got more conservative. Now younger generations appear to be breaking that trend. Let's start with part one, that cliche that as that people aged into more conservative views. Is that true? Has that been true in the past?
Well, it does tend to bear out, yes. If you look at, you know, the way we break down generational cohorts in the population, people, you know, do seem to become more conservative as they age. But again, when we are putting a perspective on that sort of change over time, what we're not doing is seeing the variation that still exists, say, among the greatest generation or the baby boomers or something like that. And there has been attention recently to the fact that millennials, by some accounts, seem to be becoming more conservative at lower rates or at lesser rates or less quickly, however we want to think about that. And same for Gen Z. Some people make the argument that the circumstances under which a generation of people is sort of socialized to politics, that sort of like 18 to 30 year old period, can be shaping and can sort of put an imprint on a group of people and their experiences. But we really are going to have to wait, right, until the millennials get a little older and see if the data suggests that they are breaking from that pattern. But right now, millennials aren't really old enough for us to, other than to say perhaps they are becoming more conservative at a slower rate. We can't know anything about their ultimate trajectory because they really are too young yet.
I think in the media world, and I think in the politics world too, we try to slice and dice demographics in a lot of different ways. We mm-hmm. say, okay, well, maybe this person is a woman, they'll vote this way. Oh, they're 30 years old, they'll vote that way. But then there mm-hmm. might be race and ethnicity, economic status, veteran, non-veteran, religion, rural, urban. Like, do any particular identities seem to come to the front and say, this is something that's going to determine who someone's going to vote for? Or is there just so much going on that it's really hard to predict?
Well, so you are right to acknowledge all of the different identities that any person carries at one time, because people's political lives are the sort of, you know, sum of the fact that they are a woman or and Black and, you know, live in Georgia, et cetera. But if you want to generalize, we know that education is an enormously important influence. And if you look, say, at some of the breakdowns in the Republican primaries, right, the exit polls suggest to us that former Ambassador Haley did much better among Republican voters who have college education or more, and that former President Trump's base of support tends to be among Republicans with lower levels of education. Now, again, not perfect, because there are highly educated Republicans who have voted for the former president. But education is one of those characteristics that does seem to really make a mark, have an impact. Marital status, religiosity, certainly, as you mentioned, the rural sort of urban suburban divide. But the issue with a lot of these things is that there is an interconnection in some ways. And so if you look at rural areas of the country, people in the rural areas tend to also be people who might be older and might have lower levels of education. So all of those factors are going to combine to influence any individual.
In just our last minute or so, Kathy, 2024 election, what is the biggest demographic question on your mind in our politics?
Well, for me, it's not a demographic question so much as it is a turnout question, right? I mean, because the election is, this is the most obvious thing I will say in the next year. The election is going to be determined by the people who show up on that election day or who vote before. And so, you know, anticipating who'll turn out for the election by group, you know, by age or generation or sex or something, it's really too early for us to tell at this point. We are still, as you said in the earlier piece, a long way away from the election, and people aren't tuning in yet. Wisconsin Public Radio listeners might forget that the average American is not listening to public radio all day. So there's still, I know, it's terrible, but still a lot of education to do, a lot of awareness to do, a lot of, you know, campaign to be run to engage people, such that by the time we get to October and November, you know, we will hopefully have a better sense of levels of engagement.
Kathy, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Sure, thank you.
That's Kathleen Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Political Science, with us today to talk about trends in politics when it comes to gender gaps in liberal conservative identity and voting. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, uncertainty can be difficult to deal with, but we can learn to embrace it. Find out more with the author of the new book, Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, Ramadan is just around the corner. We'll get recipes inspired by the annual tradition. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.